Good afternoon, your honors. My name is Norton Cutler. I represent Colorado Ethics Watch. With me is my co-counsel, Bob Miller, also from Perkins Coie, and Luis Toro, who's the general counsel of Colorado Ethics Watch. This case has one basic theme. If you win a case, you don't pay attorney's fees to the other side. As pointed out by the Supreme Court of the United States in the Ruckelshaus case, it is clear that generations of American judges, lawyers, and legislators would regard it as quite inappropriate to award the loser an attorney's fee from the prevailing litigant. Excuse me, I want to divide my time 9 and 6. I'm sorry, I forgot to make that clear.
All right, counsel. Normally, we don't make any comment about that. We let you watch your time. But if you want me to tell you at 6, I will do so.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
Indeed, in a recent campaign finance case before this court, the court vacated a fee award solely because the underlying complete dismissal motion was reversed and the case proceeded. I'm going to cite that case because it wasn't in our briefs. That's Lambert versus the Ritter Inaugural Committee, 218 P3rd, 1115. And the page cite is page 1123.
Pardon me, counsel, have you given the other side notice that you would be relying on that case?
I'm sorry, I forgot to, Your Honor.
All right, we'll talk with other counsel about that.
A copy of that case.
We'll talk with them about that when they get up here. Thank you.
Here, Colorado Ethics Watch unequivocally won the case against Clear the Bench. The ALJ found that Clear the Bench needed to register as a political committee. This court recently upheld that ruling in an order dated March 15, 2012. Yet for some reason, the ALJ awarded fees against Colorado Ethics Watch when he found that Ethics Watch's first complaint was not right. But he allowed the filing of a supplemental complaint. A cursory examination of the chronology of the case shows that the ALJ should have either amended the complaint, nunc pro tunc, since by the time he ruled, all three justices seeking retention had filed, or simply allowed the supplemental complaint without awarding any fees.
Counsel, I'd like to turn right away to the definition of candidate under the Constitution, because I'm confused about something, and I'm looking at section 2.2 of the Constitutional Amendment, which defines candidate, and I'm trying to understand what's the relationship between the second sentence and the third sentence in that paragraph. The second sentence is the one that talks specifically about a candidate, including a judge or a justice of any court of record who seeks to be retained pursuant to the provisions of another section. And then that other section says that the way a judge or a justice does that is by filing this declaration of intent with the Secretary of State. And that seemed to be the basis of the trial court's holding on the original complaint, that declaration hadn't been filed at the time. But then there's this other sentence right after that which says, person is a candidate for election if the person has publicly announced an intention to seek election to public office or retention of a judicial office. But then it says, and thereafter has received a contribution or made an expenditure. Now, judges and justices don't ever do that. So I'm trying to figure out how that last sentence plays out here. Because how could you ever be a candidate if you don't receive a contribution?
Certainly, in the full definition of the Constitution, I agree that's a very good question. And that's why the timing question is a very interesting question. Ethics Watch's position is that because everyone knew that at least some of the justices were going to stand for retention and were candidates, that there were candidates out there.
How did you know that?
Pardon me?
How did they know that when they hadn't declared yet?
Because both Ethics Watch and indeed Clear the Bench, when you look at their postings on their websites from the contemporaneous period, which are in the record at page 79 and page 812, both were campaigning, or Ethics Watch was campaigning against the justices at that point in time and presumed that they would stand.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Cutler. Isn't the problem with the the verb presumed or assumed. We know, at least in this case, one of those four justices did not stand for retention. And thus, isn't there a problem with having jumped the gun on the filing here? Because until they declare their intent, there isn't really an issue, is there?
There seemed to be an issue in Clear the Bench's mind, and that was Ethics Watch's problem. In April of 2010, because there had been so much publicity by Clear the Bench, Ethics Watch checked with the Colorado Secretary of State to see whether they had filed, and found that they had, and that was also when the first filing deadline was, and they had indeed filed a report, but as an issue committee, not as a candidate committee.
Mr. Cutler, is the focus on, is the candidate a candidate, or is the focus on the committee that is registering?
Isn't the focus on both? The way I understand the ruling in the other case, which I think would be law of this case, since they haven't appealed yet, or even if they did appeal, I think it's law of this case for this argument. This court has already found that they were candidates because they were standing to be elected.
But that was after May 28th, at least one of the candidates?
Yes, Justice Bender filed on May 28th. Prior to that time, Ethics Watch's issue was that they wanted to prevent Clear the Bench from raising unlimited amounts of money, and Clear the Bench had already raised two sets of campaign contributions that were above the 525 limit when they checked, and that their only recourse was to file a complaint at that point in time, asserting that indeed Clear the Bench was certainly treating everybody as a candidate and campaigning against them.
Well, pardon me for interrupting. What if none of the justices had declared for retention?
Ever?
Yeah.
Then I guess Clear the Bench would have declared victory, similar to what they did with Justice Malarkey when they claimed they persuaded her to retire.
But that's not my question. My question has to do with, if none of them had declared their intent to seek retention, would it have mattered if Clear the Bench had, in your word, campaigned and said these people should not be retained?
I suppose that if the ALJ had made his ruling prior to May 28th, or indeed within some reasonable period of time relative to May 28th, that might have made a difference. But here, and if I could take you quickly through the chronology.
Sure.
On May 5, Colorado Ethics Watch filed their complaint. That was a couple of weeks after they read the first report. On May 13th, Clear the Bench sent a letter to Colorado Ethics Watch saying your complaint is frivolous, not because it was premature. They were relying then upon basically estoppel and the statute of limitations. They never brought up prematurity on May 13th. Then on May 28th, basically 3 weeks after Ethics Watch filed, Justice Bender declared that made any issue about ripeness moot because by then Justice Bender had declared. Ethics Watch sort of touched off the real filings in the case by filing a motion for summary judgment on June 16th. About a week later, Clear the Bench filed their answer. Again, they didn't bring up that this was a premature complaint. And on June 28th, about 10 days later, Clear the Bench filed its response and cross motion for summary judgment. For the first time, they brought up the issue that the complaint was premature. However,
Mr. Cutler, your ethics.
Thank you. I'll take another minute and take that off my rebuttal. But at that point, they only devoted four of their 24 pages to the issue. They clearly didn't think much of the issue. The ALJ issued his final order on July 23rd, or his order on the motion for summary judgment, where he found that the complaint was premature, but he then allowed them to file a supplemental complaint under Rule 15D. He did not dismiss the case. So the case was never dismissed. A supplemental complaint was filed, and Ethics Watch prevailed. In summary, winners don't pay losers' attorneys' fees to the losers, and the first complaint was substantially justified, if only because, in the end, Ethics Watch won. Thank you.
Russell, you've got right on 5 minutes.
May it please the court, I'm Stephen Klenda, and I represent Clear the Bench, Colorado.
Before you get going, Mr. Klenda, I'd like to ask you if you would like to respond to the citation of that case that we have for the first time now. Not now, but we'll give you the opportunity to provide us with a written response, no more than, let's say, 2 pages. Pursuant to our rules, if you wish to do so. If you don't wish to, you don't.
I would wish to do so, Your Honor.
All right. And can you do that within, say, 3 working days of today?
I believe so, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you. Your Honor, Colorado Ethics Watch is inviting this court to do 2 things. It's inviting it to rewrite the fee statute at issue here in 3 ways. And to ignore the Supreme Court's opinion in Crandall in order to avoid the deterrent effect of a mandatory fee statute in this case. And this court should reject both of those invitations. In the first instance, the fee statute that the legislature adopted here was not a prevailing party fee statute. It was a statute that said an ALJ shall mandatorily award fees for any part of an action that lacks substantial justification. There's no exception in the statute that says those fees do not have to be awarded if a party eventually prevails on the merits. There is no prevailing party get out of jail free card in the fee statute. If the ALJ awards fees for part of an action that is groundless, the fees must be awarded. And that's exactly what the Supreme Court did not do, rejected in an attempt to do in Crandall. It said that the legislature had adopted a fee statute. The purpose of the fee statute was deterrent. It was deterrent in the sense that it was mandatory, and so the Colorado Supreme Court would not read an exception into that statute that the legislature did not adopt. That's the first way that Colorado Ethics Watch invites this court to rewrite the fee statute at issue here.
So let me ask you a question about that aspect of your argument. Is there any difference substantively between the way this particular fee statute is set up and what it's trying to accomplish and 1317.101 and the following sections, which are the general statutory provisions on frivolous and groundless lawsuits?
This particular fee statute was adopted in a particular context.
I understand that, but substantively, is it any different?
This statute refers to the frivolous and groundless fee statute, and in that sense, they're very similar, but the legislature adopted this fee statute for a particular purpose, and that does make it substantively different, even though the same standards might apply.
Yes, that was my question. Do the same standards apply?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Because I believe, if memory serves me correctly, that 1317.101 is incorporated or referenced in the underlying fee statute here.
May I ask a follow-up question? You just said that the claims were substantively different. How were they substantively different?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I may have misspoken.
All right.
That's my recollection.
Okay. You were citing the statute stating that any part of the action, if it were frivolous, you can get attorney fees.
That's right.
And so I'm asking which part would be substantively different from the part that Colorado Ethics Watch prevailed on?
Certainly, Your Honor. The ALJ would only be authorized to award attorney's fees for that part of the action that he found to be groundless, and that would be the part up until the summary judgment ruling on our cross motion for summary judgment, when he actually awarded fees.
So as a substantive matter, was the claim any different?
As a substantive matter, there was overlap between the two complaints. We acknowledge that, and we concede that. But where the trial court, where the ALJ erred in this instance, is to violate the rule of Crandall and to undermine the deterrent purpose of the statute by refusing to award fees that were incurred as a result of the initial complaint he found to be groundless, even though they were related and useful in a later part of the action. That's where the trial court fundamentally erred, Your Honor.
I thought the trial court did exactly what you said it didn't do. It just apportioned the percentages, perhaps not in a way that you wanted.
No, Your Honor, those are two different roles. For apportionment, what the trial court, what the ALJ was required to do is to look at a particular part of the case that he found to be frivolous or groundless and see what part of the fees related to that case. And he did that. But what he also did in doing that is to say, I'm not going to give you fees for work that you did, that even though you incurred those fees as a result of the fact that the initial complaint was filed, the complaint that the ALJ determined to be groundless, we're not going to give you those fees because they were useful later on. That's not apportionment. That's denying Clear the Bench Colorado fees for a portion of the case that the ALJ specifically found to be frivolous and groundless.
Did the judge use the word useful, or did the judge say you would have incurred those fees anyway?
I believe he said that we would have incurred them anyway, but I'd be happy to check the record to be certain, Your Honor.
Assuming that that's what he said, isn't that somewhat different from useful?
I don't think there's a substantive difference, Your Honor, because under the rule of Crandall, and indeed under the rule of Kraft as well, to effectuate the deterrent effect and purpose of the mandatory groundless fee award, a party must be awarded all of the fees that they incur as a result of a groundless complaint, even if those fees are useful to defending a later part of the action that is not groundless.
Pardon me, Mr. Our standard of review here is abuse of discretion, right?
It is, Your Honor.
So would you explain to me why this was an abuse of the trial court's discretion?
Simple, Your Honor, because the trial court did not apply the correct legal standard. In reducing Colorado Clear the Bench's fee award, the ALJ distinguished Crandall on its facts when actually its reasoning applies. The reasoning of Crandall, which I've gone into a little bit, was simply that when the legislature adopts a mandatory fee statute, it's inappropriate for a court to undercut the effectiveness of that statute by refusing to award fees just because they might have been related and might have been related to subsequent related litigation. And the trial court, the ALJ, distinguished Crandall just because it adopted or dealt with a distinct statute, when in fact the reasoning of Crandall is what controlled here. With respect to your point, though, Your Honor, we do have an abuse of discretion standard here. And under that standard, the trial court, the ALJ, should be upheld on any ground in the record. And there are a couple grounds in the record that supports the ALJ's decision that were not mentioned in the briefs. The first reason that the ALJ should be upheld is on the basis of Clear the Bench Colorado's statute of limitations defense, which the ALJ did not address, but which requires a complaint regarding registration as a political or issue committee to be filed within 180 days of registration.
You argue statute of limitations in your briefs on appeal?
It was not argued in the briefs on appeal.
So why should we consider
that it was argued below? Because you must uphold the ALJ on any ground that the record reflects that justifies upholding it, and that would uphold it, Your Honor.
But don't you have an obligation to bring that to our attention before now?
Your Honor, it did not seem to be an issue that merited briefing, but it is an issue that supports the ALJ's decision.
Mr. Clinton, let me ask you the same question I've asked Mr. Cutler, because I'm really confused about this constitutional definition of candidate. And I'm trying to figure out, with this last sentence in Section 2.2, how a judge or a justice can ever become a candidate, even if they file their notice of intent with the Secretary of State. Because it uses the word and thereafter has received a contribution. Judges or justices are never going to receive a contribution, are they? And so, I mean, I don't know where you go with that. So help me with that.
Your Honor, I can answer that in one of two ways. Another division of this court, of course, held that the second sentence of that definition merely expands the first sentence of that definition. As you're pointing out, that can be a difficult interpretation to sustain if a judge or justice does not receive a contribution. In fact,
they're barred from doing that.
In fact, there's no evidence in the record, not only that no judge or justice received a contribution or made an expenditure, but that even publicly announced. That's completely absent from the record below.
It seems to me you could get to publicly announced by saying that's what you do when you file your declaration of intent with the Secretary of State. Although it doesn't say that, I acknowledge that. I don't know what that last sentence means, but it specifically says it includes somebody who's seeking retention for a judicial office, and I quite just frankly don't understand it, and I don't know how to apply that definition.
Well, Your Honor, I think the straightforward way to apply that definition is to say that a judge or justice cannot be a candidate unless they have filed a declaration of intent to run. But I must acknowledge that that interpretation is contrary to the other division of this court's recent decision on the merits.
Thank you.
Thank you. Getting back briefly to the grounds in the record that also support the ALJ's decision. The ALJ made specific factual findings regarding Colorado Ethics Watch. It found that Colorado Ethics Watch, by using the term may in its complaint, knew and should have known as a matter of public record when it filed its complaint that its complaint that none of the judges or justices had filed an intent to run as a candidate. And further, it should have known that its interpretation of the statute was contrary to its plain language. Those are, at least the first, is a factual finding. There is basis in the record to support that factual finding, and therefore this court should affirm the administrative law judge. But getting back to the attempt to rewrite the fee statute, Colorado Ethics Watch has relied heavily on the fact that this action was divided into two parts, which were really just a single complaint. But that makes not one whit of difference, whether it was one complaint or two, a supplemented complaint or not, because the plain language of the statute requires the ALJ to award fees for any part of an action that he finds to be frivolous or groundless. So the procedural niceties or posture of the case below don't matter. The third way that Colorado Ethics Watch has asked this court to rewrite the fee statute at issue here is to read the word candidate out of the definition of out of the fee statute. This court mentioned earlier that the obligation to file as a political committee is triggered when a judge or justice files as a candidate. And the ALJ properly noted that the statute, in its plain language, does not say possible candidate. It does not say prospective candidate. It doesn't say potential candidate. It says an actual real-life candidate, which requires an intent and declaration of intent to run. No judge or justice filed such a declaration here, and therefore the ALJ's determination that Colorado Ethics Watch's complaint was groundless should be upheld. Thank you.
Counsel? Cutler, you've got it's under 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me try to take another run at Judge Loeb's excellent question.
Well, and I may be making it harder for everybody, but it's bemusing me.
Consulting with Mr. Toro, who did try the case below, not me, and I like his answer, which is, when you look at 12A, it defines a political committee, and I think I may have misspoke about candidate committees the first time. This is a political committee. A candidate committee is one which the candidate him or herself has. A political committee is where you're opposing somebody. Political committee means any person other than a natural person or a group of two or more persons, including natural persons, that have accepted or made contributions or expenditures in excess of $200 to support or oppose the nomination or election of one or more candidates. Now, I think under that definition, if everybody presumes a person is a candidate, which seems to be the only thing you really have going with a judge, then it's a political committee. And I think that's what this court has already found. Certainly, when you look at the definitions, and your other question was a good one, this Section 2.2 definition of candidate has sort of two categories. One is for people who have announced. The second is for people who more or less jumped the gun. In other words, they raised some money even though they didn't announce. And I think that's what the other division of this court already found as the meaning of that definition. Now, Ethics Watch still takes the position that it was right on the issue of when it could file, but we accept the fact that the ALJ did not rule in our favor. We didn't bother to appeal that because the ALJ gave us an opportunity to file a supplemental complaint, and we won that, and we won the issue that we cared about, which is that when you're a political committee opposing judges, you should be subject to limits. But we still think that filing was reasonable, and the standard as set forth previously in this court is, can the filer of the complaint present no rational argument based on evidence or law to support the complaint? Now here, Ethics Watch certainly presented rational evidence to support that portion of its complaint. The rational evidence was that Clear the Bench was running around the state and had a website which said, don't vote for these justices, and indeed eventually claimed credit when Justice Malarkey, who never declared, retired.
Is your argument that the definition of candidate is ambiguous?
I would think so, yes, particularly vis-a-vis judges. I do not think the... Unfortunately, when we choose to legislate via that type of amendment with the voters, you're sort of stuck with what the voters do, and I'm not sure they anticipated this case when they passed that.
You make that argument to the ALJ that the definition of candidate was ambiguous.
No. What we argued to the ALJ was that under that definition of candidate, these judges were candidates then. Now, Clear the Bench's argument brought up a couple points that I wanted to respond to, and they reminded me of one of the other reasons why, Ethics Watch had a rational basis for its complaint. which is that clearly the bench was arguing statute of limitations, too. They were sort of making a catch-22 argument. We filed as an issue committee back in April of 2009. Therefore, you can't make any complaints now about what we did more than 180 days ago. But at the same time, we're not really a committee yet because nobody filed for retention. They were in a very tough position there, and that's another reason why they went ahead and filed the complaint that they did. The statute of limitations argument did not survive the first complaint, I guess because it wasn't dismissed. It was just that clear the bench realized that it was inconsistent with the other argument, which they won the first time. Now let's talk a little bit about Crandall and the whether or not there are mandatory fees. Crandall was just a completely different case. The plaintiff in Crandall filed more or less three different cases, lost all of them, and the judge clearly found at the end they had absolutely no right for any apportionment. May I have another 5 seconds?
5 seconds, okay.
And on Kraft, the other case they cite, that was actually sent back for some more apportionment. It does not support their position.
Counsel, thank you for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Please, all of you, drive safely home. Now.